Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
I stopped listening to people who were like, don't hunt mornings in early season. Hunting afternoons in early season is all, it's not fun because it's hot. It's going to be like 87 degrees on any given day in Alabama, and you're not going to see a deer until right at dark. I mean, it can be good, but most mornings, it's actually pretty pleasant outside. A lot of mornings, it'll be in the 60s. If you get lucky, it'll be in the 50s in the mornings. Something happens when the sun comes up and the humidity or something changes, and it makes those oaks just start releasing their acorns. And you're sitting there, and it's just starting to get light, and then all of a sudden, there's acorns falling out of the tree, and you're like, oh, let's go.
That is true. It's like you get in the dark, and they don't make it. They're not dropping a single acorn. The second, there's like some sunlight. There's like something happens and then it starts falling.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
It's just a great time to be in the woods. Welcome back, everybody, to another Thursday Q&A edition of the podcast. We are just rolling back in from Dalton, Georgia, Mobile Hunters Expo. I'm surprised I still have a voice. How are you doing, Jacob?
Doing great. Oh, it was awesome. Great show. Yeah, I thought I was going to lose my voice, too, but no, turned out pretty good, pretty solid. It was insane. I think they broke the record, the attendance record this year. I think on Saturday they had as many people show up Saturday as they did all for the whole show last year, the three-day show. So that was awesome to see. And tons of first-time listeners coming through. Say first-time listeners who have attended the show. That was great. But also, it was good to see a lot of familiar faces.
Oh, yeah.
I want to say just shout-out to the Yoder boys from Central Georgia. Them killers, they came by, seen them. And I don't remember seeing them last year. We got kind of busy, but we've seen them at some of these shows for the last handful of years. Just keep on knocking out a bunch of deer on public land. Good ones, too. Anyway.
Nice.
But yeah, it was awesome. Great show. Great time. Dylan Harper did awesome on his seminar.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Dude, it was awesome.
Dude, he got me so far. So that was the only one I was actually able to like really catch.
Yeah.
Because we were talking a lot to everybody. And man, I'll tell you what. So Dylan had his talk on Sunday, and it was about mountain hunting, terrain features, and water features in the mountains. And I mean, everyone who came by the booth and talked to me before Dylan's talk, they're like, yeah, dude, I came on Sunday so I could watch Dylan. And he like sucked the air out of the room. Like everybody in there went and watched his presentation. So I was actually able to catch most of it. It was excellent. It was really good, dude. Coming from someone who does this kind of content and everything and interviews people for a living, it was excellent. Seriously. So I think it's going to be on the Mobile Hunter podcast. And I think it's going to be on their YouTube channel. I'm not exactly sure when they might release that, but I would keep an eye out for it because the visual is a huge part of it. He had map examples, and his explanation of where you typically find your little spring heads and water sources way up in the mountains was fascinating. And how to find the ones that not really even deer or bears, but just animals in general are going to gravitate to, because you look for an area that doesn't have a lot of them, and then you find one in an area like that, and everything is just sucked into it.
Yeah, it congregates around it.
Dude, I'm telling you, it got me so fired up. I couldn't sleep last night because I got some places I want to go hunt so bad. I'm like, dude, I cannot wait. I'm so excited. Anyways.
Y'all go check out the seminar when it gets published on the Mobile Hunters YouTube channel. So, anyway, that was awesome. Show was phenomenal. Great to see a lot of you guys. But now we're on to a new week. Listen, that was kind of the kickoff for us, last show of the year for us, and it's deer season's coming very quickly. Like, it's going to be here before we know it. South Carolina's already open. South Florida's already open. I say low country South Carolina's open. We've had some listeners shoot some opening day bucks because any weapons season opens in the low country South Carolina August 15th, I believe, or August 16th. And we had multiple listeners send in photos of some bucks that they'd killed. So, pretty awesome to see that. All velvet. Mm.
Yeah, it's going to get started before we know it. Last week, I mentioned that we're going to try to do an acorn crop report, mast report. And so, I've been asking everybody on our Circle account. If you don't know what Circle is, it's our private community. It's kind of like a mix between a Facebook group and an old school hunting forum. It's awesome. And so I've been asking a lot of guys on there what they've been seeing in their neck of the woods as far as mash crop. And then also I took the opportunity to ask a bunch of people at the Mobile Hunters Expo who I got to talk to what it's looking like in their areas. And generally speaking, I talked to people from Mississippi, Louisiana, a bunch of guys from Florida, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. That's kind of mostly the crowd that I was talking to. For the most part, most people are saying that it's another pretty good acorn year. Mm-hmm. That's what I've seen here in Central Alabama. Most of the trees I've been checking are pretty loaded up again. Here in Central Alabama, I feel like it's not as heavy as last year, but it's definitely not a bust year. Just a solid mast year. Now, other people, particularly, and these questions we're about to get to, particularly in Virginia, I have been hearing that they're not having a great mast year in some areas. So we're going to get into that a little bit more. But for the most part, seems like it's been a pretty solid year. I actually texted Dylan yesterday, and let me see what he said real quick. So Dylan's up in Mountains of North Georgia, which, by the way, Dylan is starting his own podcast. It's called Mountain Oak Productions. So y'all should go check that out if you like mountain hunting. I'm sure it's going to be excellent. Let's see. He said, I asked him about the mast crop. He said the mast really varies county to county. Some mountains are loaded, and 15 miles away, they can be very scarce. So I don't know if you'd call that sparse or spotty or what, if it's mountain to mountain or ridge to ridge.
It depends. If it's in your area and it's loaded, you're like, oh, it's the best year ever for acorns. And then you're in the other county, and that's your spot that you like to hunt. And you're like, it's terrible.
So I don't know. That's why it's important, everybody. Go out in your own area. Check it for yourself. Had a great episode on Monday talking about feed trees and kind of getting ready for the early season. And I would go listen to that and then I'd go scout. Take you a pair of binoculars. I like a pair of Vortex Viper 10x42s. Take it up there, look up in the treetops. By this part of summer, you can really, really see the acorns. So shouldn't be too hard to tell if the tree's produced with a good pair of binos. But go check them and write in and let us know so we can continue to update people as we inch closer to early season. But without further ado, let's get into some questions / hot takes. These are going to be from both our website and our Circle account. So first up, this is from Corey on the website. He said, what's up, guys? I had a question I was hoping to get some answers or some insight on. Last year in Virginia, there was a mass acorn drop. You could go into any block of hardwoods and find scrapes on scrapes and tons of activity, daylight and nighttime. I've never seen so many bucks on my cameras before because of the acorn drop. I've done scouting this summer, and it seems like all of the oak trees are dry and dropped last year. The area I'm hunting is not near any type of mass crop or planted field. I think you meant to say like agriculture there. Mm-hmm. So he's not close to any kind of agriculture. So I'm looking for information on how to navigate finding the food. I've always heard find the food and you'll find the does, and if you find the does, you'll find the bucks. The food will be tougher this year without the oak trees. Thanks, guys. All right. So Virginia, sounds like spotty mass crop. What do you think?
Well, it depends. For early season, it's just abundance of broadleaf forbs and just greenery on the ground that they're going to feed on. Later in the season, it's going to be like kind of the holdovers, I feel like, of some of that. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you can get sunlight coming through the ground or, you know, hitting the forest floor is going to be huge. Problem is with Virginia, depending on where you're at in Virginia, whether you're hunting public or private land. I know some of the guys on public land kind of talk about, kind of like guys in North Georgia, National Forest, they're not cutting or they're not cutting enough. So you don't have the abundance of green vegetation except for Barton.
Who's the guy? Ralph Barton.
Ralph Barton. He talked about finding some areas where they're cutting on some of the National Forest, some of the public land up there, and it's like night and day difference between deer activity. A lot more sign around it, a lot more vegetation, a lot more food and cover. But really, that's what you're going to have to kind of focus on too. Also, something else, if you're in Virginia, if you get beech trees, check for beech nuts. That's something you taught me a couple years ago, and we looked at down kind of more south Alabama, and found beech trees that were producing beech nuts. Beech nuts are tiny little suckers. I've heard Andrew talk about them for a while and never even paid attention to them. And finally, when I realized what they were, I mean, they are tiny little suckers. I mean, they are little bitty.
Yep.
Don't be thinking you're looking for an acorn. I mean, it's like they're like the size of maybe a water oak, if not acorn, if not smaller than that. Probably actually smaller than that. Deer will feed on that. Turkeys will feed on that as well. So that could also be another mass producing tree that could be producing this year. It seems like in some areas that they're very hit or miss. It's not like even as often as some red oaks and white oaks. You know, people talk about red oaks. It's like a 2-year cycle. It takes them 2 years for mature. And that can definitely, you know, you have a late frost one spring, you still might have a decent crop of acorns that fall, but the next year those buds didn't really produce and you might not have any acorns or vice versa. So any kind of greenery on the forest floor is going to be huge. And we actually talked to, my mind's going blank, I can see his face, from kind of Jersey, PA, New York, hence all that. Paul Patera, Lord. He's talking about like them eating the roots of ferns. Like digging up ferns at certain times of the year, and you can actually see where they're feeding. That's, again, big wood setting, no mass. You know, they'll go after, like, those bulbs of the fern roots and eat those. So there's a lot of other things for them to eat outside the mass, you know, outside of acorns. But of course, acorns, like he said, like he was talking about, like it was more bucks on and had more bucks on camera than he ever had before because of the mass. Sounded like he was in a really good spot where the deer wanted to be, you know, when it comes to that mass, and also probably them laying down more sign because they were healthier, fat, happy, tons of food. You know, they can put out a lot more sign and cover even more ground if they're healthy like that. But yeah, again, the ferns, that's just something I just remember Paul talking about. And then also just any spot that sunlight's hitting the forest floor, you're going to have a little bit more, quality food source browse for them to eat on.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all that. Beech trees in particular, they're definitely really spotty, and once they're mature, they can produce every year, but they don't always produce every year. But last year, when they produce, they really produce. Like last year, there's actually one outside of the studio right here. You park underneath that sucker when we were doing a podcast. Mm-hmm. We come in here, sit for hour and a half, 2 hours, go back out there, and your truck would be covered with them. I mean, it was just crazy how many beech nuts that thing produced. But if you got beech trees in your area, they're worth checking for sure. Also,
do you think you could see them, how small they are? Like, the ones I remember seeing on the tree was, like, there was one that was, like, not dead, but it was blown over by, like, some storms. And it was, like, eye level where you could, like, literally look through the branches and see them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never tried a glass up in a tree to look for beech nuts.
Oh, yeah, you could see them. Especially now that we're this far into summer, whatever trees produce, you're going to be able to see them. Also, there's certain kinds of hickories that a deer will actually eat. And I can't remember if it's a pignut hickory or a different kind. But it's a kind of hickory nut that's got a much thinner shell than other ones, and a deer can actually crack it in its jaws and everything. So those are potentially worth looking at. But honestly, so 2 years ago we had this situation in Alabama where it was just a total bust year for mast, and I did terrible that year. So it doesn't look like we're having that again this year, but I've already thought about the next time that happens, kind of just reevaluating everything and really doing kind of what you were talking about and focusing more on just your forest edges where there's more sunlight getting through and you've got vines or you've just got shrubs or just whatever, just more diversity, and then trying to follow the deer sign, whatever I can find, whatever deer sign I can find, and hunt that. Because that year I walked so many miles because I had it in my head. I was like, well, it's such a bust year that if I do find an oak tree that's dropping, it's going to be absolutely covered with deer. And I just never really found that. I did find some oaks that were dropping, but it was always like one oak tree somewhere. And there'd be like a little bit of sign under it, but I never saw any deer on them. And so I think that when it's that bad of a bust year, maybe those deer just are like, oh, we're just going to do something else. And they're not like walking 15 miles trying to find an oak tree. They're just going to whatever food source is easy for them to find. So the next thing down would probably be like what you're talking about, some kind of green cover. Like around here, it would be honeysuckle and greenbrier. The greenbrier at the club right now is totally leafed out, and you can find where it's browsed, but all the ones I've found, the whole bottom is like, it's got leaves all over it. I need to go take a picture of it right now, because once we hit fall and we get into December, every leaf is going to be eaten off of those things, and it's going to look like a totally different bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to do that for a good before and after photo. But things like that, native browse, that'd
Paul,
be good.
Paul, I remember one of the episodes we talked to Paul about, he was talking about like all the different things in those big woods. Now, he's further north, but I think it still relates. When there's no mass and mm-hmm. things to follow and look at browse lines and find, like, actually walking through and looking for browse.
Yeah.
That's one where he finds bucks in years when there's just poor, really poor mass production. And, again, has a lot of success doing that. So, this is one of those things, it's a lot finer-tuned woodsmanship skill is looking for that subtle browse versus looking for acorns and looking for oak trees that are dropping and just obliterated sign underneath. It's a lot more obvious than an acorn's a lot more obvious than a little greenbrier or honeysuckle or jasmine or ragweed that's been nipped off in pockets of where you're finding a lot of that sign. If it's a bust year like that, it's gonna be a tough year. Yeah, I think you're gonna quickly realize how those deer are shifting, and also they're gonna be probably focused. You know, he talked about last year having more bucks on his camera than ever. If it's truly gonna be a bust year, that pattern is probably not going to hold up. Whatever he saw last year and how the deer were using it, they're going to be where they have to be this year versus where they want to be like they were last year.
Yeah.
Because, again, food's going to be a lot more limited for them.
So I was telling you the other day, I'm pretty excited because what I had these bucks doing 2 years ago on my cameras in this one area that I hunt, last year they totally changed. And I left the cameras out there. The cameras have been on these certain trees, on these certain ridge points for 3 years now. Three full seasons. I've just went in there and changed the batteries. They haven't come off the tree in 3 years. The first year, they, you know, had a certain pattern, and I felt like they were pretty killable, and I just didn't really capitalize on it. Didn't really hunt in there very much. Year two, I got more serious about it because I was like, okay, I have my annual data. And even though it was early season, I was like, still, I think they're going to be in there. Year two, which was last year, they didn't do anything. Like, they did not even, they weren't really even there. I still left the camera there all year because it's a giant pain to go get it. So I basically just left it anyways. And I was really curious to see if they ever did show up in the rut, which they did not. I had like one shooter buck come through there a couple times, but totally inconsistent. So I was getting ready to go get those cameras and finally move them. And just 2 weeks ago, it's like someone flipped a switch and now there's all kinds of bucks in front of that camera, including the number one buck that I really want to kill this year. And so they're doing what they were doing 2 years ago on the bust year. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but for some reason this summer, they're doing exactly what they were doing two summers ago. So I'm really eager to get in there and check it out a little bit more and see what's going on. And what's really nice is the area that they're showing up is not that hard to get to. So I feel like I'll actually go bow hunt it. Because the other time, they were like in an area where I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to go in there when it's kind of warm outside. Mm. But the area that they're in, I'm like, oh yeah, I'd walk in there, no problem.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LiDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LiDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LiDAR is now available on Onyx Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LiDAR feature and boom, it's going to come on and you're going to see what I'm talking about. The LiDAR is going to allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LiDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LiDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on Onyx Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your Onyx Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LiDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Y'all have heard me say it a bunch over the years. I love having a diversified freezer. Obviously, we eat a lot of venison around our house, and if I can have some fish in the freezer, maybe some small game, that's even better. But the truth is, I still eat plenty of beef, and I like having really good beef on hand without having to make another trip to the grocery store. That's one of the reasons I've used Omaha Steaks. They help me keep my freezer stocked, and when we decide we want burgers or steaks, I already know I've got the quality meat ready to go. Everything comes individually vacuum sealed, so I can pull out exactly what I need instead of having to thaw a whole pack, just like how I do with my wild game. And it's consistently really good. It's like going to a really nice butcher without having to go to a really nice butcher. One thing I'm really excited to try is their Burger Perfection Flight. So they've got burger made out of all these different cuts like ribeye, filet, New York strip, brisket, and sirloin. And I've had the brisket burgers before and they are excellent. And the cool thing about the Burger Perfection Flight is you can taste the different cuts, the different textures, and kind of get a feel for everything at once. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99 plus get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. See site for details.
Deer season is nearly here, and football is back, boys. And whether you've been betting for years or you're just looking to get on a little action on some games, MyBookie is where you should play. That's what's great about MyBookie. You can find the action you want and bet it wherever you are when the game kicks off. From the tree stand, hunting camp, or on your break at work, MyBookie's there for you. And if you're new to the club, the Bet Back Bonus gives you protection on your first play. Sign up with our promo code SOUTHERNOUTDOORSMAN, all one word, then opt into the Bet Back Bonus and take your first shot with a safety net. If your first wager loses, you'll get it right back, no questions asked. Football is finally here. Get in now, cash in on this season with MyBookie. Bet on anything, anytime, anywhere with MyBookie.
So actually, my plan is to take Thomas in there, and we're going to go squirrel hunt it. Check it out.
I don't know if you realize, I don't know if he realizes, he's got something he's got to do that same weekend. That
you're what?
Doing squirrel camp that... I don't think he realized or
what?
Remembered.
What's he
got to
do?
They got a trip going down to the beach.
God.
So, yeah.
I'm going to get him. All right.
Get you all excited just to cut you down.
God. Go to the beach in September?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What's happening to Thomas? All right. We got another question coming on this topic. This is from Carl. I believe Carl is also from Virginia. He said, I was wondering, when years that have been unseasonably dry, how do others face the situation to find buck tracks? I've checked several trail systems in my area along with water sources. This past weekend, I grid searched an area to cut a buck track. Not for sure what the acreage was, but when I finished, my watch said I covered 13 miles. In those miles, I found plenty of doe and fawn tracks, but also had a bachelor group of bucks walk up within 10 yards, and once they moved out of the area, I checked to see where they were standing, if they left any tracks, but the soil was too dry, even after a rain that morning, by the time they passed me. I usually don't have a hard time locating tracks. To add, I'm hoping to find a decent buck for youth weekend for my son. And then paraphrasing a little bit, to answer what you asked from last week's episode about mass crop, I'm in the western part of Virginia, and I do not see any acorns in the area I was scouting, but the last 2 years have been bumper crops. So another report from Virginia, not looking too good on the acorn crop. Now, finding tracks on unusually dry years. You got any suggestions, advice there?
I mean, unless it's a creek crossing, it's got to be a pretty soft-soiled creek. If it's real rocky, you ain't going to find tracks there either.
Yep.
I wouldn't worry about tracks all that much, to be 100% honest, until you get some more moisture. If you've hunted any air, if anyone's listening, you've hunted any air for any amount of years, any amount of seasons, you know, one, two seasons, or 25, you should have a decent idea of where you've seen sign, where you've seen buck tracks, where you've seen deer, and so on. Yeah, I'll just kind of relate back to that, just like kind of throw the tracks out the windows. Like, if you find one, great. But I'll just focus on a lot more of, like, where's, like, some of the better habitat. Throw some cameras out if you want to use cameras. And wait for some of that sign to pop up as well to kind of confirm some of that. You know, if it's a bad mass year. Thing is, and we've talked to guys about this, if you have a bad mass year, kind of goes in with the tracks, but if you have a bad mass year, or you've experienced bad mass years in the past, and, like, for us, it was a rough year. I don't know what I learned that year that really was going to be indicative of the next time we have that. But I'll tell you one thing. I ain't going to do the same thing I did last time. Okay?
Yep.
I ain't staying down in a little creek bottom just like, oh, early bow season, I'm just going to try to see if I can find a deer slip there. I'm going somewhere else.
Yeah.
But hopefully taking from some past experiences in similar conditions and replicating that. Like, I think Scott Seals talked about that one of the times we had him on, where he's like, when you – at least if you're in the moment and you're kind of taking mental notes or even writing stuff down of, like, certain conditions, when you see those same conditions, you know, in a following season, whether it's next year or a couple years later, having something you can revert back to of, like, what worked or what didn't work. And a lot of times learning what didn't work previously in that same kind of conditions, finding bucks, don't try to do that again. Like, try to do something a little bit different and see if it works for you. The problem is when you have different conditions, specifically with moisture, you know, wet years, dry years, bad mass crops, good mass crops, is a lot of times it gets so jumbled up that it's hard to, like, stay focused of, like, hey, this, even though it might be a bad year for you, you're struggling, what you're learning that year could play off or could help you out for for years to come, it's hard to remember that stuff. Okay. Yeah. It's hard to be like too in the moment, though, too focused at the moment and not thinking years in the future of remembering like what worked, what didn't work, so you could play off that. So I'll just say for everybody, I'm talking to myself too, to pay attention to those conditions and take some kind of notes or something, at least general of like where you find deer, where you not find deer, what's working, what's not working in the conditions for that season in general. So you have that to kind of play off for maybe a couple years from now when we have similar conditions.
Yeah. 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 I mean, if you're having trouble finding those tracks right now, I agree with you. I wouldn't really focus on the tracks if it sounds like the conditions just aren't right for them. But if you just really, really, really want to find a track, you could do the old school track trap method where you go find some places that deer are flowing through, take your rake in there, like a hard tooth rake especially, and rake all the leaves out of the way, and then actually break up the ground a little bit, get it a little bit dusty if it's dry, and almost like you're making like a little bitty garden bed or whatever. You don't have to like plow it up or anything, but just scrape it up pretty good with that hard tooth rake to break that dust up, break the dirt up so it's not all hard packed. And then you got a nice track surface right there. So maybe do it, you know, a nice line across a little ridge point or something that you think the deer are coming through. And we've talked to guys who do that, and you'll definitely find tracks if you do it like that.
So I just, my thought is like, unless he's just 100% anti-camera, just throwing a couple cameras out and keep cameras moving.
Yeah.
Like, don't let them sit super long. If you're just trying to locate something, like, give it 10 days. If nothing happens on that camera, keep kind of moving it a little bit.
Yeah.
And try to fine-tune where the deer are at. Because a track can tell you something, but a photo is, to me, even more valuable if you want to use cameras. I know some guys don't want to use cameras. Like, I don't use cameras. But, like, in that circumstance, I can see how that could really play off for you.
Yeah.
Or pay off for you just by doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't want to use the camera, maybe take a leaf blower in there and just blow off a ridge point, and maybe you'll find some tracks on it.
I can't remember. Is it Virginia bait state? I don't know.
I can't remember either. I'm not sure.
If it is, you're on public land. A little aerial reconnaissance. If it's a bait state and they're running corn or something on their property, not saying hunt the property line, but walk it and look. And see if you can find any sign right there.
Get on OnX, look at that imagery, and start looking for them feeder shadows on the fields right off the edge of the public.
I mean, legitimately, and then like play off that a little bit. Just something else to kind of think about.
All right, let's get to a hot take. This is from our Circle account. If you want to join our Circle, which you should if you're listening to this, you can find that link in the description of this podcast. This is from Cody. He said, hot take, if your entire hunting season depends on the rut, you probably haven't learned how to hunt October. What do you think? If your entire hunting season depends on the rut, basically saying you're not totally well-rounded, I guess.
Sometimes it's good to be a specialist.
Oh, that's a good comeback.
I mean, yeah, but it's a hot take. No, Cody, I like it, dude. I like it. If your entire hunting season depends on the rut, you probably haven't learned to hunt October. I mean, you're probably right, but I don't see their reasoning, like why it's negative or you know. I'll say this. For the average guy working, you know, you got a little PTO time, get to take some time off work, or you just take time, unpaid time off work. Most guys are saving for the rut, trying to make something happen in that time period. But yeah, there are certain guys we've had on who are very good about killing deer early. Now, I say October. Most states are open by October. Alabama's one of the later opening states, October 15th, for the majority of the state. There's a couple pockets that open October 1st. And, you know, when it comes to killing a mature buck, or just killing a buck in general in October, he's kind of hit or miss. Ben Davis, great example of a guy who can do it.
Yeah.
But again, he's hunting features all year round. It ain't just a early season strategy. I think that is definitely a hot take. You probably haven't learned to hunt October. I mean, yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right, dude. I don't know. I mean, shoot does early. I know some guys that do that. Some guys are like, and a lot of times it's because a buck's maybe not, but especially if you're hunting a small piece of private land, you're just not right where he wants to be in daylight hours. Mm-hmm. And it just is what it is. Public land, you got enough space, you can really roam, not be close to property lines. But like on, you know, smaller acreage private land, you know, 100 acres or so, there might not be a buck you want to shoot that's bedding on your place. and you might be out of the game until pre-rut when he's actually getting up, coming off your neighbor's place to come to yours to look for some doe groups. And I know plenty of guys that try to shoot all their does in bow season early before, you know, you kind of get later on in the season. So to each their own, but Cody, that is a hot take.
Yep.
You don't have to agree on it. That's a hot, well, hot take should not be agreeable. If everyone's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, it's not a hot take.
Yeah, Daniel Hunter replied to it, and he said, if you're a guy who relies on early season, pre-rut, and feed patterns, and then in parentheses, with trail cams giving you the deer's pattern, and then quote-unquote hate the rut, then your hunting game is incomplete. I agree with that.
But it's the same way. It's the same thing with the October hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same perspective, but yeah, I understand that too. Absolutely. Gets the conversation going.
Yeah, I get it. I get both sides of it, though, because, like, my personality, I want to be good at all of it. I want to, like, I want to be able to get them in early season and the rut. But also, how many guys have we talked to who's, like, you know, pick one time a year? Also, I have more time to hunt than most people do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I was working my old job, it was like, yeah, okay, save up your vacation.
We hunted the rut, yeah.
Yeah, focus on the rut.
It's the great equalizer.
That's when you're going to kill
some deer. You're not killing a specific deer necessarily during the rut, but you kill a deer.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on what your standards are. You can find you a buck during the rut.
Yeah. Also, my perspective has changed a lot on early season in these last couple of years where I've actually tried to focus on it. Dude, I think it's a great time of year to kill a big old buck. But anyway.
My favorite thing about early season would be just the ease of hiding in a tree.
Oh, yeah.
That is it.
Dude.
You don't have to climb. I mean, even in pines. If you got saplings going around some pines where you can kind of get tucked up in it, it's pretty good. But if you can hunt a little bit of hardwoods, you can hide so much easier and get away with so much more visually early season than you can later in the season. The problem is the finicky winds and how the wind likes to swirl early season, especially whether it's flatland, hill country, mountains, it doesn't matter. Kind of same across the board. So that's you know, that's the challenging aspect of it. But yeah, it's fun when it works out. I mean, one of my best encounters with a really good deer was October 7th in Tennessee. It was early season. Cold front came through. Wasn't focused at all on hunting oaks. There was red oak. There's a red oak and white oak ridge behind me. I walked through that to get to the edge of a bedding thicket and freaking saw 14 deer, two young. If I didn't shoot a freaking spike open today in Tennessee, would have shot one of these 105, 110 inch 8 points. Maybe not 110. That might be probably 105 inch 8 point. Just, you know, nice rag buck. Anyway, I came in and then I had a freaking stud come walking in at 8:30 in the morning. Last year I saw that morning come walking in to 25 yards. Too freaking quiet though. Couldn't hear them. That's another thing about early season. Early season is kind of tough from the aspect of like hearing a deer coming.
Yeah.
If there's still some moisture, leaves haven't fallen yet. And those leaves that are on the ground, they've been trampled on and weathered for 9 months. Deer can walk through pretty quiet. And that caught me off guard. That sucker popped out. I was freaking texting Bud Jake Memory. He just seen a big one. I look up and I didn't hear nothing. He's just walking right there in front of me, 25 yards, coming through this open, big old non-tip. Anyways, it was awesome. It was October 7th and it was a cold front came through. I mean, it was like 35 degrees that morning, which does not always happen. But when it does, give me a cold front early season with some thick cover, good habitat diversity, with some oaks close by, I'm all in for it.
Yeah, buddy. All right, let's move on. We got a question about velvet seasons. This is from Jake Hollinsworth. He said, I'd like y'all's opinion. If your target buck shows up during velvet, would you let him walk to potentially get him with his full rack during regular season or take him in velvet? I got a velvet tag for the first time this season, and I've been seeing my target buck on camera right around daybreak/dusk this summer. What would you guys do?
Okay, it doesn't say what state he's in.
No.
I think, if I remember, Jake, sorry if I messes up, I think Jake's in Mississippi. I think, and they get their velvet season. It's like mid-September. By the time that velvet season's open, they're just hardening their antlers.
Yes.
They're not really growing anymore. Like, I don't think it's going to change. Like, oh, he's going to, you know, he's going to be 5 inches smaller than what he's going to be. He's going to score higher, being honest.
Yeah.
Trust me, I know this. He'll score higher if he's got his velvet on him than when the velvet comes off. Trust me.
That's a great
I kicked myself for not scoring my velvet 8 point before he dried. because if I would have scored him the second I killed him through buck measures, he's 140.
140 all
140
day.
140 inch deer. All
I remember when we were all standing around that buck when he was sitting there dead in front of us, we were like 140.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just because I've seen before and after photos after like the velvet dried and everything, it's just the boner. Anyways, this is a little waterway, but I'll give you a couple extra inches. Yeah. He scored like 137, like 7/8 or something. He shrank up big time. So, yeah. Where I'm trying to get at. Plus, I like killing a velvet deer. Like, I really, it's cool. I enjoy it. He's an awesome buck. He's Emlyn's favorite buck I've got.
He said, Emmy said that he's feminine.
Feminine, yeah. He's pretty. He's pretty blonde. Personally, if it was me, I'd shoot him. If I had the velvet season opportunity, I'd shoot him then. Again, he's hardening. I think their season's like September. I think it's like early mid-September. It's really not that early of a velvet hunt. I mean, in Alabama, they still probably be in velvet too. But if you get an opportunity and you want to mount a velvet deer, the problem about mounting a velvet deer, it's a little pricey. It's more expensive than a normal shoulder mount because of how they preserve the antlers, the velvet. But it's a cool opportunity. If you got an opportunity to get your target buck during the rut, who knows, maybe come the rut or get your target buck during the velvet season. That's awesome. You get two or three buck tags in Mississippi later in the season. Who knows? You may have an old trespasser buck as Troy Pottinger would say,
yeah,
come walking on. You never seen that deer before, but you can get you another one.
Yeah.
So,
no, you're exactly right. They're done growing. They're not going to add any more inches. They're just hardening their antlers at that point. That, and if you have an opportunity to kill him, I would kill him because there's no guarantee of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you might not get another chance. So if he's being really patternable and you're interested in participating in a velvet hunt, then yeah, I would not wait for the opportunity at all. Wait.
Cooper's got a funny reply to him. He said, Jake Hollinsworth, velvet bro, don't risk him skipping town for does and some FUD crank him on open day. I'm that FUD. Let him come by me, brother.
Jacob's like, it's me.
It's me.
I'm the FUD.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Oh.
All right. Moving on. This is from Tyler. This is a website submission. He said, what would you guys say about finding out how many does to harvest to make the ratio to bucks and does equal? Does this go according to how many stay on the property, not what passes through? Would love to know the feedback from you guys. So I'll start with this because I'm pretty sure that we've gotten multiple methods of doing this from different people we've interviewed over the years, different biologists and different managers. The one that pops into my head, probably because it's the most recent, is Larry Weishen. And him talking about how they measure their buck-to-doe ratio, and that is that he just keeps a journal, and he asks the hunters on the property to keep a journal of how many deer they see and what they are every single hunt. And then at the end of the year, he calculates the ratio. And I think you asked him about, well, like, what if they're, like, going to the same food plot and seeing the same three does every day? And he's like, doesn't matter. We're doing it off sightings, essentially. So that's how you get your ratio. And then as far as killing does, I don't know.
What state are you in? How many tags do you get?
Yeah, how many tags do you get? How many deer do you think are on the property?
Yeah. How many are you seeing? Are you going out on a food plot? You got 60 acres and you're going out on a food plot, and on any one food plot in your place, you see 14 or 15 does a sit.
Yeah.
Probably need to take that many. If that's just on one food plot one evening, you got another camera over here lighting off.
Yeah.
And also, it depends on what your neighbor's doing. A lot of neighbors, I mean, just a lot of people just don't shoot does anymore. I mean, yeah. The harvest records show that for most states, bucks are way more shot than does are. Who was it? Which biologist? Was it Grant Woods? I'm not sure. One of them was talking about, like, that's going to bother me. I don't know. We've had so many biologists on talk about doe harvest. But when you shoot does, you are going to see a decline in sightings, okay? Like,
yes.
Specifically on food plots. That's where you see
might have been Dishkoff.
Might have been Dishkoff, yeah. But you're going to see a decline of sightings. And there was, like, a formula for it. The thing is also the backflow of deer. They're like, you're not going to... you're not going to kill out does on any one property because they're not staying on your property. They're coming in off of, there's neighboring doe family groups that you never probably see on your neighbors. And the thing is, they're naturally going to flow. And like, say if you're seeing, say on 100 acres, you killed 10 does. Some people are like, oh, that's crazy. That's a lot of deer. Your neighbors have plenty of deer as well. If they're not killing any does, they're going to naturally drift on your place because you're going to start having better habitat, better food quality for them because then it's not getting browsed down nearly as heavily as your neighbors. So you're going to have a backflow of more and more does. And that's why like people talk about like Alan Summerford. It's like you got to keep staying on them year over year over year. And at some point you might mitigate a little bit. I mean, if you're hyper effective and you live in a state like Alabama, Georgia, you can kill a lot of does, but you can kill 10, okay? Mm-hmm. For some states, that's a lot. I did the math in Alabama. It's like over 200 deer you kill legally a year in Alabama. Kill 2 does a day and you get $3 and you get an extra bonus buck tag if you go on a WMA bonus buck hunt. But I don't know anybody doing that. And, yeah, you can donate the meat, Hunters for the Hungry, if your state has that program and so on, or just have needy families. Like, you go to church or something, get some families that love some deer meat, you know, kill a couple for them, you know, take them to the process, let them pick them up, all that kind of stuff. But on average, from the guys we've talked to, the biologists and everybody, rarely, and actually it was Ditchkoff, rarely have they ever seen where they shot too many does and you actually had a population decline on
yes.
the place.
Yeah.
Instead of stabilizing the population and getting a better buck-to-doe ratio. Ditchkoff, Dr. Ditchkoff, had one situation. It was on Fort Rucker where they went down there and they made, I forgot, I don't know what the regulation was, but they were pretty much shooting every day on site. And it was, that had happened, took a ton of does, forget what the number was, but it was also when the influx of coyotes had moved in, and coyotes were also hammering just the deer herd in general and the fawning, and yep. they had low recruitment the following
predator
year.
Pit.
So, yeah, there was a predator pit. So, like, they couldn't get back out of it, so then they had to shut down doe harvest for ever how many seasons to get them back out of it. Realistically, that's not going to happen on most properties. That's what he was saying. He's like, it's only that one circumstance, and it was a weird circumstance of how it happened. But in general, you're not going to take too many does off a property. So.
Yep. All right. This is an interesting submission from Circle. This is from Evan. He said he framed it as a hot take. I'm very curious on your thoughts on this. Hot take: if your neighbor won't get on with letting nice 2.5-year-olds walk in order to shoot bigger mature deer, start encouraging them to shoot whatever they want and smaller bucks in hopes that they just shoot the small ones before the big one walks out or overpressures / tags out before they ever get a chance at the big one. Then you do the opposite hunt when the time is right and pass deer. What are your thoughts on that?
That is interesting.
I think it's a terrible idea.
That is interesting.
But what do you think?
I mean, listen, hot take.
I shouldn't say it's a terrible idea.
I mean, it's reverse psychology to the final.
I think it's a good idea. I think you're doing something right by just encourage them to shoot what they want. Like, if they want to shoot smaller deer, you know, that's your neighbor. That, you know, you got to respect that.
I mean, and also, it really just depends on how they hunt.
Okay? Yeah.
Like, what is the likelihood they're going to kill? Well, it also depends. Are you wanting certain deer to get past? You know, if you're a landowner, small mm-hmm. landowner, are you wanting certain deer to get past so hopefully they make it to 4, 5, 6 years old? Or is there already some really nice deer out there and here shooting whatever? Because the thing is, like, how many bucks can they kill? Like, what state did it say what state he's in? Mm. I can't even find that question, by the way. Anyway, I think there's a bunch of factors on it. The problem is, like, Lindsey Thomas Jr. talked about this. Not a problem. But, like, you're never going to get all your neighbors on the same page. Not everybody wants to shoot mature bucks, okay? Some people just want to truly shoot whatever walks out in front of them to fill the freezer. If it's legal for them to kill it, they won't take it. That's perfectly fine. The frustrating thing would be, if you're a landowner, you got another landowner next to you that has 3 or 4 people hunting it, and they're all kind of like that, there's nothing you really do, because, I mean, you're not putting up a high fence next on the property line, even though Anthony's having that happen on this place. Funny enough, they actually are putting a high fence up on the backside of his property. But there's nothing you can really do about it. And it's one of those things that's not worth having, like, an argument and, like, a dispute over that. Only thing you can do is, if that's truly what's happening, you better have the best food and the best cover in your place, and you better not hunt it very often. Kind of like what he was talking about, kind of laying off of it until after they tag out. But you better have the best food, the best cover, and very low impact on it, so the deer feel super safe right there, and they don't feel safe on your neighbor's property. Because if the neighbor's got pre-hung stands, they don't really care about wind direction, they're just baiting or whatever, they're going to kill some deer, no doubt, and they're going to kill some young deer, no doubt. They may get lucky and kill a nice buck. But if you get the best cover or the best food source on your place, maybe you can kind of keep them from going over there until, you know, after legal light. But it's hard to do that. Even with, you know, you have 100 acres, a deer's not staying on 100 acres all day long. I mean, they're going to wander, and especially all season. So there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
But hot take, yeah.
I see where he's getting at. I don't think the logic quite works out, because if you're trying to have more bucks, you know, make it and get older, then, you know, them shooting those deer, while they might not kill the older bucks that year, you're killing your seed out. You know, like, you're not going to have older bucks in 2 years if they're killing them. That being said, if that's what they want to do, then that's great, and you should be happy for them. You know, if you have a one management going, your neighbor has a different one, obviously that can be aggravating. But it's important to remember that at the end of the day, we're all just trying to have fun. It's supposed to be fun for everybody. So, you know, let them enjoy their hunt how they want to enjoy it, and you enjoy your hunt how you want to enjoy yours. And, you know, I think it really has more to do. I mean, basically, you're kind of encouraging to do what it sounds like they're already doing, which is good. That I think that's actually the first step into, if you ever wanted to, like, kind of nudge them into whatever management practice you're doing, that's actually the way to do it. It's just be nice to them and be encouraging and supportive and everything, and have a good relationship with them. And while they might not be adopting the same practices that you have this year, maybe in 3 or 4 or 5 years, they will. So I think that's the right attitude to have with it. And then also with what you're talking about, Evan, which is kind of laying off the places that you hunt, let the pressure go down in those areas. Hopefully the deer get kind of pushed into them. I think that's the exact right thing to do. So actually, I take back what I said. I don't think it's a terrible idea. I think it's a great idea. It works. So
I mean, if you're encouraging to them, whatever, you know, have a good time. You know, Lindsay Thomas was talking about, like, how by example they were trying to make a difference in their neighborhood of property owners.
Yeah.
And he's like, we got a lot of them on board, but there's some that still aren't on board. And, you know, anytime I can turn it, instead of, like, trying to reprimand somebody for, you know, doing something legal and harvest a deer that just wasn't something that he wanted to, you know, get shot, just show him, like, hey, can I pull, like, he talked about the whole example of pulling a jawbone and aging the deer, and just educating people. Like, oh, that's a nice buck. Let me, do you mind if I pull the jawbone? Yeah, pull the jawbone, look at it. Oh, there's a 2-year-old, great 2-year-old. Awesome. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, and just kind of turn into, like, a little educational aspect of it.
Yeah.
And also maybe even show within reason. You got to know your landowners. You know, don't want somebody trespassing on your place. But, you know, if you've shot some nice deer, show them, like, what the potential could be out there. Or trail cameras. Trail camera photos. So,
you know, that's why Michael Perry posts his that's one of the reasons that Perry will take a picture with his bucks in front of WMA signs, mm-hmm. which, man, gets some people angry. But I understand both sides of it. But one of the reasons that Perry says that he does that, he's like, I want people to understand what is possible out here and what opportunity exists. One, to protect the land that he hunts, because if people care about it, then, you know, they'll protect it. And then two, you know, if someone sees the 196 that Perry killed a couple years ago, they might think about, well, maybe I should hold out for a bigger deer or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons that he does that. Which, again, people get real fired up about.
Dude, my neighbor, and he's probably watching this, old Randy, like, talking about, like, big deer like this, but, like, anyways, let deer get aged. He showed me a photo. I've talked to him about it. Did I show you that photo? I don't think the deer is older than a year and a half old. I don't think he's 2. And
he's
got it is like a 90-pound buck with, like, 115 inches on his head. It is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, if that deer makes, I'm like, shoot him. If y'all want to shoot him, shoot him. But it's on their hunt club, so good luck. Someone's going to probably shoot that deer. Even on accident, they just see his rack. They don't see his body, neck, shoot him.
If that deer came chasing a doe by me,
oh, yeah. Like,
I would smoke it.
Yeah, it'd be Arkansas all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done that.
You've done that, yeah.
On a much smaller deer.
Yeah. And, but I'm like, dude, if that deer, if y'all decide, like, y'all want that deer to try to make it, y'all got plenty of ground. If that deer's on a do not kill list and y'all let him live a couple more years, he will be a once in a lifetime buck for somebody on that club.
Yeah, 100%.
100%.
That's one of the most impressive deer I've ever seen as far as like a young deer.
For Alabama, absolutely.
Oh my gosh, yeah. All right, this is from another Circle member, Randy.
No.
He said, my cousin and I are heading to West Tennessee public land for the August velvet hunt. What should we focus on? Mornings, evenings, creek bottoms. It's hilly, has some swampy areas, various smaller cuts of different ages. I did see that the area is covered in kudzu, and there are a few ag fields that border the public. Onyx shows beans and maybe some corn. Any tips / advice is appreciated.
Yeah, I actually talked to Randy on the Hunter's Hangout, and we talked a lot about that, and Clay gave him some pointers on that, too. The place they're talking about going is an interesting piece of public, and I was like, dude, you're going to have to find habitat edges. Like, deer are going to be, if there's ag on private adjacent to it, they're going to be going to wherever the beans are at and trying to cut them off in the woods, or look at other pieces of public land that have a little more opportunity for that. But also where he's talking about going, I'm like, dude, would be killer in October. Killer, but he's coming over from East Tennessee, so he's driving good ways to get over there. But I was like, because I brought up the whole equation, and like, is this just like you're just going out there for the 3-day hunt, or is this a place that you're gonna like, you're gonna hunt for the velvet hunt, but also you're gonna expand your hunting opportunities on this place throughout the season, and kind of maybe over a couple of years you find something worthwhile? Because I'm like, if that's the case, the place they're talking about going, it would be probably pretty good for that, because it was set up really good for October, November hunting and so on. So it really kind of comes down to opportunity. But yeah, the whole kudzu, creek bottoms, where to hunt. The problem is, if deer in velvet, they're not that laying down at least fresh noticeable sign. I'm not talking about tracks. Like, yes, you'll find tracks as long as the conditions are right to find tracks. You can find old scrapes that they may still be hitting, but you're not going to find fresh rubs. And they're still going to be bachelored up, which sounds awesome until you realize if they're bachelored up, they're in pockets. So you might find something that looks really good, but there might not be a bachelor group anywhere in the area, and you might not see a deer.
Yep.
So that's the tough part about doing that kind of in a more big wood setting like what he's talking about here. Yes, there's open ground around the public and all that, but being able to lay eyes on a deer and be able to move on a deer and reposition on a deer is going to be super valuable. And that was kind of some of the feedback I kind of gave him on that.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, I don't have much to add because I did that velvet hunt like twice. And it was bad, but
terrible.
It was bad, boys. Real bad. Hey, this is a great hot take from Sam Brown on Circle. He said, hot take, the majority of hardcore public land hunters, given the opportunity, would rather hunt a nice piece of private property, going to preset stands and blinds, and knowing you're still going to see and kill mature bucks is better than dragging a pack full of stuff into a thicket on public.
Woo! All right, leave it in the comments. I want to know from public land guys if you fall into that category.
Yeah, I gotta know. See, I feel like I would be the guy who would hunt that place, but I would still go. There's certain areas, because I kind of do that now, because the club's pretty nice, and it's got places where you could definitely sit in a pre-hung, your shooting house and kill deer, but I still kind of hunt my own spots, and I still hunt public ground too. So I don't know. You're kind of the same way.
Yeah, but listen, like last year when I was in that club, dude, I sat at some shooting houses. I loved it. It was fun.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not against somebody doing that if you got a place to do it. I didn't kill any deer. I have a shooting house, pre-hung set. Only deer I shot at doe, we were sitting on the ground on a road intersection on the place, closed road intersection. But and that's where I saw one of the shooters was in that same spot where they were crossing through. So that's a hot take. Most people, most public land hunters, given the opportunity, would do that. I'd say given the opportunity, yeah, they probably, some would. I know a couple that probably wouldn't. At least outspoken about it. I haven't given them the opportunity. I should ask them. Because Perry's been one. He's like, I don't want to spend... I've talked to him. I don't want to put Perry under the bus. But, like, I've heard him talk a little bit about it. He's like, I just don't care to, you know, pay money to be in a lease or club. Now, this is an opportunity. Maybe someone got invited. Yeah, if you're invited, go. Absolutely. It's something
different. Experience
it. It's something different. I'll be honest. I'll tell you this, and I'll say it to everybody. There is something. If you've got some private ground, club, lease, own the ground, sitting over a food plot every now and then is a fun experience.
Yeah.
It's different. It's nice.
Yeah.
Change of pace. Not sweating your butt climbing up in a tree and everything. It is nice to do every so often. It's not something that – it's like anything. It's not a one-trick pony. You know, you do that. I know plenty of guys that do that and kill deer. But most of the guys that we talked to that actually started hunting public land – they had private land, but maybe it's not big acreage, and they're tired of doing the same thing over and over.
They got bored.
Yeah, that's what happened to me back in, like, growing up, and when I got to college, I found out about public land. It's like, dude, I've got tens of thousands of acres I can go run around on instead of sitting at the same shooting house. Because I got bored sitting in the same shooting house. You knew what was going to come out, more than likely, based off trail cameras. Same spots over and over again. And I wanted the sense of adventure, and that's why I went to public.
Yeah. That's what keeps me doing the public stuff, is just the adventure of it. Mm-hmm. That, and I keep finding bigger deer on public than I do on my private.
Yeah.
But that's a subject for another day.
Yeah. But it's a hot take. Listen,
that's a great hot take.
I'd love to get...
I want to see this comment section.
Yeah, I'd love people to leave comments and just let us know what's your thoughts on that. Or would you not take that opportunity if you only exclusively hunt public land and just stay on the public? Or would you take the opportunity to go hunt some private land and go sit on some food plots on some pre-hung stands or shooting houses?
Yeah. All right, let's do some kind of rapid fire hot takes. We'll try to get through these relatively quickly. This is from the website submission from Nader. He said, a thermal drone ain't no different than a live scope. Don't be a hater about one and have the other in your boat. I'm poor and don't have either. Thanks, guys.
Me too. I don't have either. I don't have either. I don't have either. Neither. Neither either.
That's hilarious.
Oh, Nader.
That is hilarious. I don't have either one either. Yeah. I'd love a live scope.
Hey, I have fished with a live scope, though.
I've never fished with a live scope.
Fiance's dad, Dempsey, he's got one on his boat. It's fun. It's like a video game. And listen, there is a blurred line. We talked about it. Because, like, just because you can see him doesn't mean you can catch him. Okay?
Right.
Maybe that's the differentiating factor. You're not going down there and spear gunning one, which that might be pretty tough, too. But I don't know. Anyways. So just because you see the, like, say crappie, for example, doesn't mean you're going to catch them, but you can wear them out. If it's the right school, they want to bite, you're catching them until they school off of it, and then you chase them down.
I mean, it helps when you can pitch it right in their mouth.
I'm telling you, it's fun. Dude, it is different. Let me tell you, okay? Different. But I think there's going to be some regulations coming around that might change.
Really? Like what?
There's just been a ton of talk about changing regulations on public, on certain bodies of water, to limit or shut off potential live scope.
Really?
It's been talked about. I don't know if it's been pushed
through. I haven't heard that yet.
Oh, well, you ain't in the circle, bro.
Man, I'm going to totally miss the whole boat on live scope. Yeah, they're going to ban it before I can ever
try. They're
going
to ban it before you can get on it. Dude, yeah, exactly.
I need to get down there with Dempsey. Well, Dempsey and good time.
Yeah. But, because backstory, hold on. This is supposed to be quick. It ain't going to be quick for a second because I do have some feedback on it. I asked one of the top fisheries biologists in the state of Alabama, Dr. Steve Salmon from Auburn University,
yep,
about live scope years ago when we had a fishing podcast, and I was running the fishing podcast. So, yep.
Southern Waters.
Southern Waters. Forgot about it. Wow. Anyway, Southern Waters. And I asked him specifically about live scope. This is like 2020 maybe, about live scope and the implementation of live scope potentially being a causing population decline of certain species of fish, specifically crappie. Because most people, if they're catching bass, they're releasing bass. They're not necessarily eating the fish. But they could die from catch and release or from tournament angling. Because come to find out, they don't survive very well when you let them out of live well. They've been in a live well all day. They don't do very good. I forgot what the mortality...
Might as well take them home and fillet them. Yeah,
the mortality rate was, I think, over 60% on a couple of studies they did on Lake Gunnersville. Mortality rate
60%.
Yeah.
All right, tournament guy. I don't want to hear nothing. Next time, I take a 4-pounder home and put them on a taco.
To be honest, listen. This is a hot take. Let me tell you. Yeah. This might get the conversation going. Bass anglers talk about, like, oh, you don't eat bass, you don't kill fish. If they're fishing tournaments, they're like kind of the guy who's like not kind of anti hunting and anti commercial farming and all this stuff for like cattle, but they still go to McDonald's and eat a Big Mac. They're still getting it, but they just don't want to be a part of the process. They're still killing fish.
Oh, yeah.
They're just not there present when they die. Dude, 6 hours later.
A bass is one of the finest eating fish there is. I don't care what anybody says.
But anyway,
continue.
But anyway, so that's maybe a hot take. They're still killing fish based off the studies they've done. It's like close to 60% mortality rate after a bass tournament.
What did Steve say about crappie declining?
So that's what we're
kind of... This is a hunt podcast. Way off subject.
Yeah, but what he was saying about... When I asked him about, like, could you see this as a... hurting a population in certain bodies of water, especially small bodies of water, say small, like under 10,000 acres, for crappie. especially guys going out there and catching them. And he's like, at the moment, he's like, I don't think it's going to be a problem because it's not widespread. Fast forward 6 years, it is very widespread, and the price of the units are coming down. You can get an older unit. You find guys on the Facebook Marketplace for a small head unit and that whatever 34 transducer for like under $1,000 now. Still expensive, but wow. Like relatively compared to like, you know, what they were, it's not that bad. And almost everybody has one on their boat now. And everybody I know that's a crappie angler has one on their boat now. And if they can go out and fish a lot, anyways, there's now been talk about potential population declines in certain bodies of water. Nothing like necessarily in Alabama, but there's other bodies of water in other states, smaller bodies of water, that get fished really heavily. And come to find out, fish have now adapted to LiveScope, supposedly. There's some guys out there that believe, and they're trying to, I think, study it, that the frequency, that constant frequency, instead of like a pulsing from like a side imaging, which actually, take that back, don't know the science about, but the LiveScope is a constant transmission mm-hmm. that fish can potentially sense that. I have no idea. Anyway, so it's changing.
I remember when you explained LiveScope to me back when you were interviewing Dr. Sammons about it, mm-hmm. and I did not get it. I was like, what are you talking about? Could not like understand what it was.
It's LiDAR under the water that's active. That's what yeah. it is. Shows everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, but okay, we got up the whole LiveScope stuff and bass fishing, but there's no difference between LiveScope and thermal drone. I'll be honest, that is a pretty... I feel like that's a pretty close analogy.
Yeah, that's a great...
That's going to get people fired
up. I was sitting here, I was like, yeah, they're pretty much... That's it.
Yeah.
The only thing that could make it worse is if you could ride on the drone and shoot at the deer from the drone.
Or just mount a weapon to the drone and shoot remotely.
Oh, yeah, an armed drone?
Yeah.
With a weapon system on it?
Like a Predator drone. Like, hey.
Oh, my God.
Instead of a Hellfire missile, you just got a 30-06 mounted to it, dude. Scoped.
All right.
When someone comes up with that, we got real problems.
We got to get off this.
Okay. All right. Anyways, next hot take.
All right. This is from Circle. This is Taylor Weeks. He says, hot take, bow hunting without a peep sight is easier than with a peep. You just need a solid anchor system. Another hot take, pizza is better as leftovers, not fresh. Ooh, that's kind of tough. If you heat it right, pizza is better as leftovers. If you throw it in a skillet to reheat it instead of doing it in the microwave.
Oh, yeah.
Get that bottom crunchy.
No, I got another hot take. You do it in the oven first at like 350. Mm-hmm. Get where everything, I mean, it's bubbling cheese, and then you put it in the skillet and crisp up the bottom.
Oh,
next level. Anyways, all right. That's a hot take. But
see, if you throw a glass lid on your skillet, though, you can kind of bake. You can warm up the whole thing and get it crispy at
the same time. Yeah, you can, especially if you drop a little bit of water in there, let it steam up. I know. Fat boy knows how to get some pizza heated up, okay? You don't put it in a microwave. That is JV, okay?
JV.
Listen, have some patience.
All right. Pete sight, no peep.
I've never shot no peep. You shot no peep. So you can do that for a while.
Yeah, I loved it. I shot with a kisser button. And an IQ bow sight, which has their retina lock, and you can use that retina lock as almost a second anchor point. And what it's supposed to be is it's supposed to tell you whether or not you're torquing your grip at all. And so it works very well for that. And you can shoot peepless. And this is back when I did that for probably 4 or 5 years at least. And it's really nice because you don't have to deal with peep twist ever, which is great. And then second of all, light transmission, if you're shooting really early or really late, you're not looking through a dark little peephole.
Hey, you feathering the line between legal and illegal. You know, daylight, you know.
I mean, you up under that canopy, it's dark before legal ends. Anyways, light transmission, it can help with just seeing the pins, seeing where you're aiming on the deer and all that, which is really nice. The limitation to it is definitely your anchors and accuracy at distance.
Distance, yeah.
Now, what I was saying is when I was shooting that setup for all those years, that's back when I was like pretty strict. Like I wasn't ever going to shoot over 30. And I really didn't have to because at the time I was living in Auburn and I was hunting in South Alabama a lot. And it's so thick down there that there was just wasn't a lot of opportunities for me to even shoot over 30.
Yeah.
Hunting in the woods, hunting close to bedding and all that. So it really didn't matter for me. When I moved back up here into Central Alabama, and all of a sudden I'm in areas where it is pretty common to have an opportunity about 40 yards, that's when I switched back to a peep sight because it's just easier to get it more consistent. Maybe if you practice more than I did, you could become more consistent shooting peepless, but it can be done, and I enjoyed it. So,
yeah, you're a huge proponent about it. I tried it one time with your bro. I did not like it. I didn't like the whole retina lock thing. Because then I started paying attention more to that than my pins. It's like, oh crap, the freaking thing's moving on me.
I had a little system in my head where when I got drawn back, it was like, okay, kisser button, and then I look at my bubble level, retina lock, pins, and then shoot. Like basically, I would put the pins where I wanted it, so I'd get aligned. Okay, well, how did I do it? I come to anchor, kisser button, put the pin where I want it to hit, check the bubble level, check the retina lock, back to the pin, shoot. And that was kind of my little system. All right, moving on. This is from Joe Bowman. He said, hot take, gun hunting, where I know my longest shot is inside of 40 yards, but my 20-gauge rifled slug is a better option over my rifle. What do you think?
As long as it's maneuverable, sure.
Yeah.
The one thing I always talk about, I'm like, I've always wanted to kill a deer with a slug. Never done it.
I've killed one with a slug.
I know.
I've killed multiple with a slug.
I've never killed one with a slug. I want to do it at some point. I think that comes down to personal preference. Because, this came up at the Mobile Hunters Expo. Talking about, like, close shots with a rifle. I mean, guys, like, specific saddle hunting. Or, you know, tree stand. Doesn't matter. If it's tight woods, okay, and you can't shoot past 40 yards. Like, 40 yards is kind of a limiting factor. Specifically during the rut. And if it's conditions where you can't hear deer coming all that well, it is very stressful when you can only see that deer at, say, like 25, 30 yards. It pops in, pops out before you can get the gun and make your move to get on your gun and so on. So you just got to be, super cautious about that, being ready and being able to have a good system of getting your gun ready. If I don't know if that's a hot take necessarily. If you want to shoot your 20-gauge slug, that's great.
Brush gun.
I mean, yeah, as long, but it depends on how long it is. If it's a 28-inch barrel, I don't want to take that. I mean, if you're shooting like an 18-inch barrel, 16-inch barrel, or 20-inch barrel shotgun, it's not too bad.
I think he's talking about just ability to carry through cover.
Yeah, I've got a 45-70 for that I really like.
Yeah.
45-70 is nasty, boys. Let me tell you, that is nasty. I'm excited to hunt more with 45-70 this coming year.
Yeah.
Killed my first one buck in Arkansas last year with it. Which, come to find out, I kind of forgot I shot that deer. That was the first deer I killed last year, was a buck in Arkansas.
Yeah.
And shot him with 45-70. And that was the first year I've ever killed with 45-70. And I now love it.
I forgot about that deer, too. And I was doing something on the website yesterday. And I was going through our photos from last year. And I was like, oh, yeah. It said Arkansas 2025. I'm like, we went to Arkansas? And then I clicked on that. I was like, oh, yeah, Jacob did.
Yeah, three bucks. Two in Alabama, one in Arkansas last year.
All right.
A bunch of does.
Next up, Alex Williams, hot take. In the woods, chambering around in a bolt action just feels better than knocking an arrow, coming from a bow and rifle hunter. Agree.
Yeah, I'm right there with him. Yeah.
Were you about to disagree?
No. I was just kind of like, listen. No, I agree with him. I'm just surprised he said it. I mean, to be honest, I love it. It's one of those things, dude. You got that the cool, crisp morning, and you put your hand on that bolt, that cold bolt, and you close it. Right, put that shell in there. It's like, oh.
We're like, we're here to do business today, boys.
The great equalizer.
We ain't playing around anymore. Yep. All right. Next up, William Ware, hot take. To preserve the integrity of hunting in North America, high fence hunting should be outlawed. Thoughts?
Never done it. Don't know anybody. Well, I probably could think of somebody who maybe has done it before. But to me, it's a money game. High fence hunting.
Yeah.
I mean, there. I don't know if it preserves the integrity of hunting in North America, because I don't know how many people truly go hunt on a high fence.
Yeah.
Because I do know there's high fences that aren't like $10,000, $12,000. Like, you go kill a deer on a high fence, like a 120, 130-inch deer for probably a couple grand. I have met one guy, and I'm trying to remember. I don't remember the name. I wouldn't say his name anyways. But he's telling me that he knows some guys that are high fence hunters, and the reason they do it is, and this is to me a cop out, but again, maybe a little bit of a hot take too. Let us know in the comments. He said some of the guys he knows that does it is because they don't have a lot of time to hunt, and they don't want to pay for a lease. They don't want to do all that. They just want to have one good hunt a year, and they'll go on a high fence hunt, go shoot a deer, and they're done for the rest of the year. To me, that's a cop out.
Yeah,
but it was like, yeah. And I think it might have been the same guy. He was saying that one of the guys he knows, he's killed high fence buck, 200 50, 260 inch deer. And he tells the story and everything like it's a legit hunt and a wild animal. He doesn't ever mention there's a fence when he's like showing up to people.
Yeah.
You know, at his house. So like, taking for a grain of salt. Does that, would that preserve the hunting in North America? I don't know. I mean, it's a hot take, but like, yeah. I think it's a hot take. It should be outlawed for sure. But I don't know how many people truly do it and what all that entails.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LiDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LiDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LiDAR is now available on OnX Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LiDAR feature and boom, it's gonna come on and you're gonna see what I'm talking about. The LiDAR is gonna allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LiDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LiDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool and it's available now on OnX Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your OnX Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LiDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with OnX Hunt.
We did joke about there's that high fence for sale in Alabama. I was joking with you if we had the money to buy it. It's got elk on it. We could kill elk in Alabama on it. But,
oh, yeah.
But that's totally different. Anyway.
All right, let's move on. I agree. I don't know. I mean, it's here. It's been here for a long time. I don't know if it's widespread enough, kind of like what you're saying, where it's like threatening the integrity. Also, I think you could open a can of worms, and this might get the comments going, but like, I do think there is a difference between a 100-acre high fence somewhere and a 300,000-acre high fence in Texas.
Yeah.
You know? Do you think there's a difference between those two things?
I'm glad you said that, because I brought that up to you at one point, and you're like, nah, it's a high fence, it's a high fence.
Yeah.
Because, hey, one high fence conversation I've heard from people, they're like they don't do it, but they're not necessarily against it, like if it's a big place, is like, what's the difference between like going fish in like the lake, and you get the lake's 20,000 acres, but the fish can't leave. I mean, they're in it. I mean, you track, find them, you know, especially live scope versus fishing the pond out here on the property.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, I mean,
I tear them up in that pond.
Yeah, I know.
I don't care.
You're a high fence fisherman is what I'm saying.
Yeah, give me a high fence fish.
It's different. We talk about that. Like, you don't hear anybody talk about the fishing. And again, a fish is a fish. But like, anyway.
Yeah.
You're not catching and releasing deer also on a high fence either way. You know, you're killing it. So
yeah,
a little bit different. Like, we did hear that one story from that guy we interviewed. The episode hasn't come out yet, about a guy that was in the hunting space that was real prevalent, getting sponsors for killing deer. And they were on a high fence, and they started tranquilizing them and taking photos with the tranquilized deer like it was dead with the products. That will come out at some point, hopefully, guys.
I don't think he talked about
that. No, he didn't talk about the episode, but hopefully we interview the guy who was his camera guy.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah. Yes.
That, it would be hilarious. Dude,
yeah.
The guy's passed away, kind of legend in the space, but it's just a funny story. But, like,
yeah.
Actually, technically, that might be fraud. I don't know.
That is for sure.
Definitely fraud.
For sure, actually, fraud. Maybe. Yeah. Anyways. All right. This is from Eric, talking about some gear now. Andrew Longhi. Andrew and Jacob, what's y'all's recurve setup? What's your recurve setup?
It's set up in my closet.
What? You have a couple traditional bows.
Yeah, I've got a Samick Sage with, like, I think it's 35 or 40-pound limbs. Recurve off of Amazon. I've got a Howard Hill longbow that Steve Angel gave me years ago that's in that closet as well, along with my grandmother's fiberglass Shakespeare recurve, which I've never shot, don't even have a string for it. So, anyway, the only thing I really shot was that Howard Hill longbow and the Samick Sage recurve.
Yeah.
I have no setup. I've just got arrows that Steve Angel gave me, and that's what I've shot. And some of them literally feel like a piece of rebar. They're heavy suckers. Shoot pretty good. They're crazy, crazy heavy.
Yeah. I'm shooting a Bear Kodiak Magnum. It's 50-pound draw at 28 inches. I draw 28 and a half, so it's a little bit more than 50 pounds. And I'm actually building some new arrows for it. I can't remember what the spine's going to be. It's probably going to be in the 300s. And I'm going to be shooting pretty high FOC, and I think I'm going to shoot some Iron Will wide cut 125 grains. And then, you know, load up the front of it to get somewhere around, like, I don't know, 18% FOC or 16, something like that. I don't know. I haven't fully figured out what I'm going to do, but I'm rebuilding the arrows. Last year I was shooting Magna Stingers, and I like those broadheads for sure. But I don't know. Someone might have talked me into the Iron Wheels, so we'll see.
Well, right before season, you try to make the change. Should have been doing that during turkey season, dadgummit.
Nah, it don't matter. I mean, as long as you're staying practice. I mean, shooting a new setup, as long as you know how to tune it, I think it'll be all right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I want to switch to the Iron Wheels because I want to shoot the same heads out of my compound bow. And we were talking to some guys at the Mobile Hunters Expo about a guy who will, like, super tune your bow and your arrow, and it's supposed to be really, really good. We want to go interview him at some point. And his whole tuning method, and the guy really likes Iron Wheels. And I've heard... We've met the owner of Iron Wheels.
Yeah, Iron Wheel.
And he was talking about how, you know, some people get different broadhead flight out of different bows. Like, you know, this broadhead flies really good, like a field point, but this one doesn't when their bow's tuned. And basically the explanation was that on a lot of your cheaper broadheads, the actual components will have inconsistencies in the weight. So if you're shooting a three-blade fixed head, each blade might weigh a different amount. And so it's like, it's not weighted correctly. It's just, they're not very well made, or they're cheaply made. And that's why you get inconsistency. It's not the case with Iron Wheel. So the reason I haven't tried the Iron Wheels yet is because we got so much chert rock in the ground here that I just know that I'm going to dull them at some point. Like if I go bury it into a gravel creek bank, I feel like it's going to be really hard to get it sharp again, and they're very expensive. But anyways, I think I got talked into them. I think I'm going to try them out. But anyways, there'll probably be more on that. I really want to interview that guy. I'm super excited about it. But I want to shoot the same head out of both setups. So I'm just going to have to build each arrow for both the compound and the traditional bow to work with that 125 grain wide head. And so if I get a really nice, consistent head like an Iron Wheel, then it's going to make building those two arrows easier. And they're a high-quality head. So, anyways, went way too deep on that. Nicholas Crittenden said, question, how do you physically prepare for the upcoming season? Do you do anything? What do you do?
Nothing. Probably bites me in the butt.
I don't really do anything just to prepare for season, but just throughout the year, the main thing that I like to do outside of just like extra, like working out, like lifting weights, is I do like to ruck a lot, like get a backpack with some weight in it and just go for a walk, because I hate running. And so it's better cardio for me than running because I despise running. That, and it's just, it translates really well over to what we do when we hunt. Having a backpack on, carrying a tree stand in. So it just makes everything easier. You don't sweat as much when you stay in shape like that and you're used to carrying that weight. You literally do not sweat as much. A lot of people think that they're just like a sweaty person or it's like hereditary. It's probably because you're out of shape and your body is not conditioned and used to what you're making it do. So if you just go for a walk every day, it would actually help a lot. I think that would serve a lot of people well. Like if you just go walk like 1 mile a day, you'd be amazed at what that'll do for you. All right, last one. We got Chris Dugan. What would you consider a quote unquote hat trick in deer hunting? Taking a deer at three different pieces of public, taking deer in three states, taking deer with three different types of weapons, or something else?
So most states, it's three different types of weapons. I want to say, I can't remember if it's Arkansas or Virginia. Maybe both of them. I think Arkansas does it where it's like you shoot one with a bow, you shoot one with primitive weapons, which is now drastically changing because you use straight wall cartridge. It used to be muzzleloader. And then shoot one center fire rifle. And like you have it all documented, game checked, and you get like a little plaque from it. So that's why I say some most states would consider that is the three weapon choices. That'd be my answer. Three weapon choices.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I feel like that's kind of going back to the very beginning on the people who were like, you know, if you hunt October, if you hunt the rut. I feel like if you take a deer with every weapon, it kind of proves that you're a really well-rounded hunter, you know, because you're not hunting some weapons. You're limited to certain times a year with that weapon. Mm-hmm. So like in Alabama, if you're hunting with a muzzleloader, most of the time you're not hunting anywhere close to the rut.
Well, it's a 5-day season statewide. It's a Monday through Friday, but then you have management areas. That's where more of the muzzleloader opportunity is, or you just not selfishly, but you made the decision.
Yeah.
I'm not going to hunt with a center fire rifle till I kill one with a muzzleloader.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the guys that do that. Michael Perry did that, actually. I think it was the year that he shot his big deer. I think it was that year. Anyways, he had made a decision that he was going to hunt with a muzzleloader in rifle season.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, my answer to hat trick would be archery, muzzleloader, and then a center fire rifle.
Yeah.
That would be the hat trick.
Yeah, I definitely agree. All right, so I lied. This is the last one we're going to do. This is from another one from Sam Brown on Circle. He said, y'all need to bring back the segment where you recap the guest episode that just came out and give your own insight and thoughts on it, which I've been thinking about lately. I've been kind of thinking that we needed to get back to that. Because the reason that y'all probably hear us every once in a while, we call these an outro, these Thursday episodes that we do with like the Q&As. We still call it that, doing an outro. And it's because originally, it started that we would do an intro for the podcast every week where we'd like explain who the guest is going to be and yada, yada, yada. And then it would roll over into the guest interview. And then we got to talking about it. We're like, well, that's kind of dumb because we're just talking for 15 minutes about what we're about to talk to a guest about for two hours.
Yeah.
So let's, instead of doing that, we'll put it at the end and call it an outro. And it'll be like our color commentary, our thoughts on the episode. And then those got to be like 5 hours long.
We literally had 5-hour long episodes, yes.
And so we're like, this is dumb. We need to break this into two episodes.
Yeah.
And then that's how the Thursday episode came about. Mm-hmm. And why we called it an outro for a while. And then we ended up doing Q&As. And so now it's kind of a Q&A thing. It's changed over the years. But I do think it's a good idea to, you know, give our thoughts on the past episode. What do you think about Monday's episode, Ben Davis? Sawbriar.
I mean, it makes you more interested in shooting deer over feed trees. I mean, that's my biggest thing. But I do like the topic of kind of talking about certain discussion points with the Monday guests, the interviews.
Yeah.
Because some of them we get super excited about. Some of them are just like, they're really good, but there's not like, we kind of hashed everything out on the actual episode.
Yeah.
But like with Ben specifically, is the thought process of knowing when and where certain oak species are going to be dropping acorns. And by the way, we should have prefaced this on the episode. Oaks are dropping at different times of the year based off the region you're in.
Yes.
Okay. And also sometimes like the habitat terrain kind of plays a factor a little bit. But because like he was talking about like swamp chestnuts, for example, drop around like Halloween. Okay. There are other areas like South Georgia, they may be dropping in mid-September. So like, oh, you got to take all that with kind of a grain of salt of when they're dropping. That's very regionally specific. So take that, because there was a guy that left a comment about that. He's like, man, I got white oaks that don't drop until November where I hunt. And I'm like, yeah, it's not like a for sure science. Like this is the week or week span that all your white oaks are dropping. Then it's your red oaks and it's your, you know, your pin oaks and your water oaks right at the end. It's very much indicative to where you're at in the country. And I really think in certain areas, like habitat kind of plays a little bit of a factor. But anyways, I thought that was really interesting how he kind of scouts from looking at the different species and where he's going to again hunt his mountain chestnut. Also, he's talking about killing deer on mountain chestnuts. Mountain chestnut oaks, mountain oaks.
Yeah.
Which we've like kind of despised majority of the time of the show over the last 8.5 years. And he's like, they're phenomenal early season, like the first thing that drops. But one thing I should have pushed back on her ass is like, you know, most of the states, October 15th opener, by that time, it seems like there's other stuff already starting to drop. You know, you do have, like, I've seen mountain chestnuts start dropping mid-September going out. It's like, yeah, you find feed something, but that don't help me. I can't hunt here for another month. So it's like, okay, good to know.
Yeah.
But I did find that very interesting that he likes hunting mountain chestnuts early season if they're when they're dropping.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times here in Alabama in early season I have walked up on mountain chestnuts and found tons of feed sign under them and then hunted them and never seen anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it is. I think they might just have started dropping a little bit before I got there and then something else better came along. Now, that being said, we've ran into several instances where they were on the mountain chestnuts. When we hunted North Georgia a couple years ago,
yeah,
the spot we saw the most deer in was a big grove of mountain chestnuts dropping, and they were hammering them.
The most deer is a very... Like, that's a very limited term.
Everyone got mad at me because I didn't shoot a velvet spike there.
Yeah. Should have been like, old Jacob, man, listen.
Yep.
Got to pull one.
He was right under me.
Could
have stuck him. But last year, I hunted over some and had a lot of luck over him. Yeah. I saw deer every time I hunted over him.
Which I didn't realize that. At least I didn't remember that drainage you were hunting in, they were feeding on mountain chestnuts. I didn't remember that detail, so that was kind of shocking when I heard you say that on the podcast to Ben. But...
It's area specific though, but I wouldn't just write them off.
Well, the reason why I wrote them off, original when I started hunting public land, place I started hunting,
mm-hmm.
I remember, and we actually ended up having a good hunt. The deer weren't feeding on the mountain chestnuts, but we were just in a good spot where bucks were coming through. Me and my brother Christopher went into a spot I had found the day before, and there were some white oaks in there, but I was getting mixed up. I knew what a white oak was, but I saw these giant acorns laying everywhere on the side of this ridge.
Yeah.
And I thought these white oaks dropped. I come to find out it was the mountain oaks that were dropping. Me and my brother sat there and didn't find no feed sign. Didn't know what feed sign was. We're just sitting over acorns. We literally climbed 40 yards apart, ended up seeing like 7 bucks that morning on a morning hunt. Ended up having a nice 8-point walk right underneath Christopher. He was milling around. Might have been eating those mountain chestnuts. I don't know, but he was milling around and Christopher screwed. He didn't see the deer coming. So I turned back to look at him and I'm like, there's this buck 5 yards from his tree. Just milling around, he didn't know it was there, and I was like doing hand signals, like look down. He finally looked down and tried to get his bow, and that buck snapped his head up, dude, and took off running. But there was more bucks across the range from us, milling around feeding. Other than that, like you just find tons of sections of just mountain chestnuts, and a lot of guys get burnt because they sit them, but also they're sitting just where there's a bunch of them on the ground, not necessarily feed sign. Like I don't ever see deer eat on them. And that might be the factor too. There might just be a couple of trees that they're actually feeding on, and it's not like a whole ridge side that's covered in them. And that's where people get bit in the butt. Like, oh, they just don't eat them. They just don't eat them. I don't ever see any deer mm-hmm. eat them. They just lay there and rot. And I mean, you find that in certain areas where there's a ton of mountain chestnuts, they'll produce so much. Roll your ankle like nobody's business. Slide off the side of a ridge, walking on them.
Yep.
But the deer can't eat them all. I mean, I saw white oaks like that last year, and there was literally so many acorns on the ground, the herd of deer could not eat all of them. They rotted.
Yeah.
Or they were eating red eggs all the way into the springtime.
Yeah. I think it's a good lesson in, like, don't just take something that you hear from somebody or that you hear on this podcast and just take it as the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go out there and see what's going on. Because at the same time that mountain chestnut that I hunted over last year was being fed on, there was a grove of white oaks that ended up being really good about mid-November, early to mid-November. It was the weekend that you shot the buck in Arkansas. The day you shot the buck in Arkansas is the day that I cut the hair off that buck with my recurve.
See, I thought that was on... You thought you said that was on mountain oaks. Was that white oaks?
It was... No, it was on white oaks, actually.
Okay, well, you...
I went back...
You lied on the podcast, then, because you said that buck was coming to that drainage with those mountain oaks.
So, it was the does before that. So, what... I was thinking about it. What happened was the mountain oak was dropping and I kept walking past it because that's a mountain oak. And there was 4 or 5 white oaks kind of where the bottom goes down and makes a bend. And the white oak was actually dropping a little bit. And so there was acorns falling out of that white oak. And I kept hunting that white oak and I would see deer, but they weren't coming to that white oak. They were just kind of, I would like see them cross the bottom or something like that. And then walking out, it's like every time I walked out, because I was always hunting in the morning, every time I walked out, that mountain oak, the feed sign under it got heavier and heavier. And I was hunting it maybe 2 times a week or something. And I'm like, they're still feeding on this mountain oak instead of that white oak down there. And the white oak was dropping. So I put the camera on it, and sure enough, like that mountain oak still got hammered. And it wasn't until that whole group of white oaks, like all of them started dropping, that they really shifted off that area where the mountain oaks were and fully shifted over to the White Oaks. Because I don't know if it had, I don't know if it needed to just have like a certain amount of food down there before they wanted to go and eat there instead of at the Mountain Oak. Because the Mountain Oak, it was only one or two of them, but it was raining. I mean, it was really dropping. Plus, it produces a giant, you know, giant acorn. So maybe the White Oaks just had to drop a lot of their mast. But no, it was the does that I was seeing more of down there. And then once that feed sign started showing up real heavy on the White Oaks, it got really pronounced really quickly. So I think it was only like a couple days difference between the last time I'd been in there and then when I walked in and found how heavy the feed sign was on the White Oaks that I hunted the White Oaks. And then the first or second time I hunted those, that's when the bucks came in and I missed him. But it was two bucks. It was him and like a spike or something.
Yeah.
But anyways, all that to say that how many guys have we interviewed over the years who said that Mountain Oaks are like no good, don't worry about them.
A lot.
Don't even pay attention to them.
A lot.
So don't take everything you hear as the gospel. That's all I'm saying. But yeah, it was a really fun episode talking with Ben. I feel like this has been a constant theme for me over the last 4 or 5 years where I'm just getting more and more confident with my early season hunting. And also, I just enjoy it more and more. And I think part of the reason I started enjoying it more is because I stopped listening to people who were like, don't hunt mornings in early season. Hunting afternoons in early season is all, it's not fun because it's hot. It's going to be like 87 degrees on any given day in Alabama. And it's you're not going to see a deer until right at dark. I mean, it can be good, but most mornings, it's actually pretty pleasant outside. A lot of mornings, it'll be in the 60s. If you get lucky, it'll be in the 50s in the mornings. It really doesn't get warm outside until around lunchtime. So, especially when you're hunting down in those creek bottoms, dude, it's nice. Listening to the woods wake up, the crickets, it's nice and cool down there. Listening to the oaks dropping. And it's like something happens when the sun comes up and the humidity or something changes and it makes those oaks just start releasing their acorns. And you're sitting there and it's just starting to get light. And then all of a sudden there's acorns falling out of the tree. And you're like, oh, let's go.
That is true. It's like you get in the dark and they don't make it. They're not dropping a single acorn. And second, there's like some sunlight. There's like something happens and then it starts falling.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
It's just a great time to be in the woods. It's a really fun time of year to hunt. And now that I'm getting more confident with it and I'm having more experiences running into bucks like last year, my confidence is growing. I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm actually starting to figure this thing out. So anyways, I'm real excited to go do some early season hunting this year.
Yep.
Be a good time.
Other than that, appreciate everybody watching the show, listening to the show, and appreciate everybody that's been joining the circle. Had a ton of new members of us last week while we were at the Mobile Hunter Expo. Join up, but next time you hop on Circle, or if you do join Circle, make sure you join us for our Hunters Hangout meetings. We've got one going on. Well, the night we're recording this, which isn't on Thursday. Got a Hunters Hangout going up, but love talking to everybody. So if y'all want to be a part of it, check out Circle. Link down in the description down below. And other than that, thank y'all for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you back here on Monday's episode of the Southern Outdoorsman. And remember, guys, y'all stay Southern.
Around here, fall plots usually go into the ground around the beginning of September, which means right now is when decisions get made. And Whitetail Hill is who I would call before making those decisions. Like, literally call them. That's one thing that we love about working with Whitetail Hill is you can get a real person on the phone by call or text who will look at your situation, your soil, your shade, your goals, and tell you exactly which blend to plant and how to plant it. If it's the first plot you've ever put in, they'll walk you through the whole thing before and after the sale. And the seed they'll set you up with is good stuff. It's premium germination tested blends with zero filler. And their seed blends are built in Alabama, so you know it's going to handle southern conditions. So don't guess your way through another planting season. Go to whitetailhill.com/southern and use the code Southern for 10% off. And if you're not sure what to plant, ask them. Again, that's whitetailhill.com/southern and use that code Southern for 10% off.
If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody.
whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find basher groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.